Good evening once again, and thank you very much for your attendance this evening. Welcome to the 4th Annual Bhaktivedanta Swami Lecture. We'd like to extend a warm welcome to the special international guests, the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust trustees. We'd like to welcome our special guest, Mr. Nishan Balton, who's the Executive Director of the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation. As the BBT team, we would like to welcome the actual host of tonight's event, His Holiness Jodhpaita Swami, who is also the Senior Trustee of BBT Africa. We'd like to extend a welcome to Dr. Nani Singh, who is a Trustee of BBT Africa. The talk this evening will be given by His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami, and a very special welcome is extended to him himself as well. The program this evening is as follows. Let me first introduce myself. My name is Bunte, and I'll be the master of ceremonies this evening. The opening this evening will be done by Dr. Mani Singh. As I've said, he is the trustee of BBT Africa. That will then be followed by the keynote address by His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Swami. Following the keynote address, we'll open the floor for any questions or comments that the audience may have. And thereafter, we will then have a special address by Mr. Nishan Balton. The closing will be done by Mr. Mfundo Ngosi, who is also the Operations Manager of BBT Africa. And I will then conclude with the vote of thanks. I would like to welcome Dr. Mani Singh up for the opening address.
Ladies and gentlemen, members of the academic community, the members of the media who are here, Mr. Bolton from the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation, we are very grateful to have you. We also have some civil society representatives here, you're welcome. Students, friends and guests, on behalf of Jayadvaita Swami, the head of the African BBT, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to you to the 4th Annual Bhaktivedanta Swami Lecture. It's been convened here at this very prestigious university, this business school, that has formed and shaped the minds of many of our captains of industry and leaders in South African society. It is also a unique privilege, indeed a very special privilege, to have with us the divisional trustees of the Mediterranean BBT, the Chinese, Australian, North American, South Indian, North European, and Latin American divisions of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. A very special welcome to you. This Bhaktivedanta Swami Lecture, as you would know, is hosted on an annual basis by the African BBT. You may know that the BBT is the world's largest publisher of books on Vedic philosophy and thought, and it is exclusively dedicated to publishing the writings of Bhaktivedanta Swami. Since 1966, we have a record that tells us 516 million pieces of literature, or books, of Bhaktivedanta Swami has been distributed. To place this quantum in perspective, somebody on the planet every 90 seconds receives one of Bhaktivedanta Swami's books. And in the most unique way, on the streets from Moscow to Johannesburg, there's an army of volunteers who distribute these books on the streets for a small donation. Somewhere in the background, in Stockholm or in Italy, there are persons who are completely dedicated to this one author. They translate, edit, publish, and print, and make ready these huge volumes of books to Bhaktivedanta Swami. So this conveyor belt of book production and distribution is the genius of Bhaktivedanta Swami. And while you and I cannot date, and neither can science date when knowledge actually began, this remarkable author, in whose honor this lecture is named, has taken an ancient storehouse of knowledge, that's trapped and locked in the very complex Sanskrit language, and he translated it word for word, reinforced with a simple yet elaborate explanation. Now, the world has over time produced great minds, titanic thinkers that have challenged paradigms, they've opened doors and windows to things that you and I may not have experienced. And they've produced innovations that has forever changed the way we live. But Bhaktivedanta Swami, with remarkable fidelity to his past teachers, he had questioned the value of man's ever-changing plans that yield a never-changing result. He pricked our anemic thinking that tends to varnish the fundamentals of questions of life. He had an intrusive objectivity that challenged established thinking, which what makes him dear to those persons who are interested in the subject of philosophy and the deeper meaning of life. So we have today, you know, the great privilege to be work of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, over 2,200 lectures recorded by Bhaktivedanta Swami, 1,200 conversations, 6,000 letters, and over 70 books in over 60 languages. The CNN voted him as one of the top 100 most successful persons in the last century, just one position after Ronald Reagan. Yet Bhaktivedanta Swami himself was a humble man, a true servant of humanity, and an avant-garde social reformer. In 1972, he personally established the BBT as the institutional guardian of his writings. He often referred to the personality of Chaitanya, who appeared in 1486. You'd be interested to know, in the year 1486, the world registered its first copyright. At that time in ancient India, the Vedic knowledge was monopolized by a class of persons who couldn't share it openly. It was just restricted to a few. So in the spirit of Chaitanya, he wanted his BBT to indiscriminately produce and make his books available to all of humanity. So this evening, we are honored, very honored indeed, to welcome Bhaktivinoda Swami. He is a chemical engineering graduate from the Institute of Technology in South India, an advocate for alternative thought and sustainable living. And most importantly, he is a second generation student in the tradition that Bhaktivedanta Swami himself represented. So please join me in welcoming His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami to deliver the fourth annual Bhaktivedanta Swami lecture entitled Echoes of the Past: How to Achieve True Social Transformation.
Ladies and gentlemen, students, the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust organizers, and our dear chief guest, Mr. Walton. I'm here today to try to explain to you and try to give you a solution, and my talk will be based on this sequence, and I'm trying to have a little glimpse into the past and touch upon what humanity ails in, taking you a little bit beyond humanity towards higher consciousness, and giving you a solution from the works of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, from his books, towards how we could actually move towards silencing echoes of the past. The past, as you know, in South Africa, means many things to people. It's deeply emotional. It's got various different leadership issues. It has got a whole thing about oppression, about discrimination, and many, many things. Of course, I would be failing in my duty if I did not mention the wonderful, great humanitarian contribution done by our past president, Nelson Mandela, who stood out amazingly in a great attitude of forgiveness and brought out wonderful changes in negotiations and in peace and started a new chapter. But beyond what he wanted us to do and what he dreamt should be done, there are things that we face in our society now. He dreamt of a nation in all diversity, and he wanted peace, multi-racial democratic society rather than a minority rule, and he went ahead a great way in doing that. But having done that, the 20 years of independence, what have we achieved? How much have we achieved? How much have we actually gone ahead? We keep hearing these echoes from the past, and some of these indelible impressions in people's minds have not been quietened or silenced. So what really is deeply affecting everybody right inside themselves? This thing about discrimination is not something new. We have heard about this, seen about this. Here you're seeing a picture of the Holocaust during Hitler's times and how he discriminated and put to death some 5 million Jews, and out of them were 1.5 million who were children. What really moves a person to this level to be discriminating against human beings, to actually humiliate, insult the person in a human being to such a great extent? And to what levels can this go to? Why do people do that? These are questions that are very deep. And some individuals who have been deep human beings have done that, but it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient, and to such an extent that human beings have to be put back into their coordinates in space. And the United Nations, in alarm, passed this sort of a resolution saying that all human beings actually belong to a single species, and they should be respected with dignity, given equal rights, and they all descend from a common stock. It's like re-educating ourselves on who a human being should be, something that we may have forgotten, and reinstating us. And the fact that the United Nations had to do this is a sad state of affairs. It means that humanity has slipped off somewhere from between our fingers, and we are not knowing about it so much. And here in the Constitution of South Africa, we hail a new constitution, a very bold new beginning, wherein it was mentioned that we, the people of South Africa, recognize the injustices of our past, heal the divisions of the past, and establish a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights. And are we able to do that? To what extent? Although we pass these legislations, although we pass these, proposals and different types of edicts, how much do those impressions of the past remain with us? How much are we able to actually do what we need to do? Although we are talking about harmony, and although we are legislating these things, there is something deep inside every human being that cannot be legislated, that those deep feelings of differences and discrimination remain, although in a covert sense. And we can pose to be externally harmonious, but there is rumblings, there is something lurking deep inside which needs to be addressed. And what am I doing addressing this? I'm not a South African. I haven't been here. This is my second visit to South Africa, although I like the country very much, and the people are very warm and wonderful in their interactions. In what way will I be a person qualified to be able to comment on these things? Although I'm at best a vicarious participant, a second-hand participant, I know that there are others here who belong to a different generation, youngsters, who may also have not directly experienced these things, but have heard it and have actually experienced it in a different way, more intensely than I would. But still, sometimes it is very nice to have somebody from a different viewpoint having a zoomed out view of some problem and some difficulty, and because he's not placed within that difficulty, he can afford a different solution from a different angle. In that sense, I want to tell you that I'm going to take the important influences that I had as an Indian from two great personalities who I think influenced my understanding and possible solution, which may be a little long drawn. Gandhiji, he personally came here in 1893 as a young lawyer, and he was in a short stint of an assignment, and he was here in South Africa, and in his first visit to the court, he came with a turban, and he was asked to remove the turban before he could enter the court. And Gandhiji, he felt that to be an insult on his person, and he said, "I will not remove the turban." And they said, "You can't enter the court." He said, "I prefer to leave the court." And he showed to them in his first instance that I value my self-esteem, my dignity. And in this way, he went ahead to practice whatever he had to practice. And he had to interact a lot in this way. Here in Pietermaritzburg, he was thrown out of the train. He was sitting in the first class compartment, having got a first class ticket. And one of the passengers who came to sit there said, "You're a colored person, you're an Indian, you've got to get to the third class." And he refused to do so. When he refused to do so, he said, "I have a valid ticket." And he was thrown out by the conductor. His luggage was thrown out, and he was thrown out on the platform. He sat on the platform for the whole night, it's mentioned. And he said, "It's one of the greatest moments in my life, when I thought very deeply why people discriminate against human beings." And some great changes occurred in him. And he went ahead to stay for another 21 years in South Africa, take part in fighting racial discrimination. He went to the jail many times. And this is where here he tried satyagraha, or non-violent demonstration. And he gained a lot of experience in how to do it, and he made quite some headway. But after that, Gandhiji, he actually went to India. In India, he carried on his fight against British colonists. And he knew very deeply, he played very deep humanity. He knew deeply that I have to change deeply inside in order to be able to bring the change that I want in the world. And although he did everything possible to give India independence, finally he became the object and the subject of the discrimination, and he was shot dead by one of his own nationalist members. So this lets us think very deeply what we need to do. My slides here are not coming up the way I'm supposed to. It's coming up later. So what we need to do is to maybe think a little beyond what humanity is. Here I'm bringing you a quote by a famous archbishop, that we are not human beings having a spiritual experience, we are spiritual beings having a human experience. Just a little stretch beyond thinking humanely, that maybe humanity, like I said, slipped between our fingers. And we need to think about something more. Although it is very necessary to be very humane in this world, it's very necessary to extend ourselves in all humane spirit. Maybe we need to think a little bit more. In that sense, I would like to introduce, and not I don't have to introduce to you, but I'd like to bring upon the second person who influenced me very, very much, and that is His Divine Grace Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, whose books we were hearing about and how they have brought about a powerful change in many individuals in this world. First of all, Prabhupada was a Gandhian. He was a follower of Gandhi in his very younger days. And when he met his guru, his preceptor, and posed to him that there is no use fighting for any spiritual freedom, or even perpetrating something like that, when our whole country is still in the hands of the British. And when he said that, he got an amazing reply, where he was convinced that first liberation from ourselves inside, from this concept of being our material bodies, is foremost in order for us to actually become free from any other type of entanglements. His Gandhian thought actually graduated and evolved into a different understanding based on spirituality. And then, because of his deep love for humanity, he traveled all over the world and pronounced these amazing spiritual solutions and brought people together of various caste, creed, race, color, culture, and propagated an understanding of a certain unity based on spirituality. And he told us, first of all, we should understand what our real identity is, beyond race, color, creed, gender, etc. And this was one of the most important teachings, foundational teachings of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, which is the principle of unity. And Prabhupada also taught us, based on the ancient Indian tradition, that we are more than these bodies, these material, corporeal structures that we have. We are eternal spiritual beings. And we are forever existing beyond this temporary material designations. And Srila Prabhupada, he went ahead to show us to make these differences important on the basis of the body, whether I'm a man, a woman, a cat, or a dog, or short, tall, dark, fat. All these things are completely material and temporary, because we are essentially spiritual in nature, and that's how we should look at ourselves and look at others too. But contrary to that, we are very busy trying to identify ourselves with the body and putting on masks that we need to keep up with, the masks that we interact with and counter, and the mask that we need to put up ourselves. And society becomes exceedingly complicated when it is based on these principles. Here in South Africa, one of the wonderful frontline students of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, he was once interacting with Srila Prabhupada on a very important issue. He deeply personally felt that there was some racial discrimination within the society that Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada had established, and he was feeling some of that. So when he went to Srila Prabhupada and told him that, Prabhupada said, no, that shouldn't be. It's completely wrong for us to discriminate towards anybody, anything, on the basis of the body. Having said that and explained that to him, Prabhupada, in parting before leaving him, made a very, very interesting statement. He said, also, you may be wrong in taking that seriously and feeling discriminated. If you have the understanding that you are not this body alone and you're beyond this body, then why would you feel hurt? Why would you feel wronged upon? And this Bhaktivedanta Swami said was one of the most wonderful, important, deep instructions he ever received from Srila Prabhupada. And he went ahead to do amazing services. Srila Prabhupada established this society and communities all over the world which are based beyond caste, creed, color, and race. And a method of becoming happy on the basis of service to each other. I want to next bring upon to you a sort of a solution that we can think of. That is, I want to quote to you a famous historian and a great thought leader. The world's malady is spiritual. We are suffering from having sold our souls to the pursuit of maximizing material wealth, a pursuit which is spiritually wrong and practically unattainable. We have to recognize our objective and change it. This is somebody speaking from the secular world, a great historian, having found out that, really speaking, the underlying problem is something spiritual, it's nothing material. Having said that, I want to bring to you how we think, feel, will in this world. Our minds are completely occupied with material things, possessions, aspirations, and we look at others in the same way. We look at things and we want to possess them, we become very attached to it. And they look at people also as things. It's amazing that over a period of time I've seen in my lifetime how management turned from personal management to human resource. How the human being was seen as a resource, a material resource. How much is he capable? A human being became more important as a human doing. How much is he capable of giving materially? In other words, he's not considered to be a being, a human being anymore. Everybody is valued and assessed on the basis of his material talent and what he can give. So we fill our minds in judging people that way. And people go far away in terms of people-oriented, humane interactions. And we judge people differently. This kills relationships. This kills our genuine love for humanity. And our consciousness gets completely polluted with increasing material consciousness. We think matter is most important. And spiritual personalities, human beings, are no more as important. And due to this very, very intense material consciousness, we have polluted ourselves to such a great extent that we can commit such crimes on humanity and not bat an eyelid about it, and not feel bad about it. This is a very dangerous trend. Einstein reflected on this long back, before even technology took over. He said that it has become appallingly obvious that our technology has exceeded our humanity. It's a very telling, saying that we should be careful how to actually land up with ourselves and our identities and how we should relate with each other. So the moot question is, who am I who is feeling these discriminations? Who am I who consciously aspires in certain ways? And taking a peek into that reality, deeply understanding ourselves is maybe a solution to problems within ourselves. And because human society is made up of units of ourselves, human beings, but each human being makes this progress in understanding about himself, society on the whole will relate in that particular way. And then we will have a different view about others. I'm quoting here a very famous statesman called Chanakya, an Indian history. He said, Atmavat manyate jagat, the way you see yourself, you'll see the world. So things start with inside us. Who am I? What do we think about ourselves? Am I a human resource that I like to offer myself? Am I a respectable human being? I want to be respected in a particular way? Or am I a spiritual personality that was mentioned here, that I'm a spiritual being having a human experience? And if I think that way, primarily I'm a spiritual being, then I look upon others too, primarily that they are spiritual entities, and my relationship, my respect, and my humanity towards them will be altered to a great deal. So I think the foundational principle is talking, thinking, feeling, willing in that way. If you want to solve problems, we'll have to elevate ourselves to that thinking. Here is Einstein saying that we cannot solve a problem with the same consciousness that created it. So one of the most important ways and the most key and salient ways we could solve these problems are that humanity needs a spiritual upliftment, a transformation of consciousness from material to spiritual, from thinking that I am this body and looking at others in the same way and seeing them in the same way, towards looking at others as conscious human beings, spiritually very relevant. So Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada told us that these things actually are not very important. All these material designations, all these material differences, really speaking, don't matter, because what divides us in this way is very insignificant as compared to what unites us spiritually. And when we experience that spiritual upliftment and that awakening, we can see that other things are actually not very important, not very serious, and we need not pay very much of an importance to that. The more we pay importance to the spiritual aspect, the more we pay importance to increasing our spiritual quotient, the less important these other things will become. And human society, like Prabhupada said, will be a notch above. Here is a quote of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In Philadelphia, 1975, just like in your country, the black and white, they have got equal rights. And why they fight sometimes, racial fight, because of the material platform. So our point is that you come to the spiritual platform, then this equality will be possible. If you keep yourself on the material platform, then artificially you may say we are equal, but at last we shall fight. This is our proposition. Therefore we request everyone that you come to the spiritual platform, then everything will be very nice. I want to conclude by bringing you a short story told to our founder Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada by his preceptor. He spoke about a village where there was some thieving going on and nobody was able to find out who the person is, who was an expert thief. Finally, several members of the village got together and found out the watchman is a thief. He was extremely intelligent. So the watchman, when he was caught, he started running. And these people who got together started chasing him. They woke up the whole village by their running and everybody joined behind. And amazingly, the thief, as doors opened up as he was running through the streets with these people following, he did an amazing thing. He pointed ahead and said, "Thief, thief." And everybody who opened the doors thought that he's pointing at another thief whom everybody is chasing, and he's heading the chase. And in this way, he got away. He got away. Sometimes we may be pointing at things outside of us. And unbeknownst to us, we may have made it a habit to do so. But the real problem is within us, within each one of us. And because we lack that spiritual quality of seeing ourselves as spiritual beings and seeing others as spiritual beings, we may resort to legislations, propositions, and all sorts of resolutions and blame everybody else. But we all have to take equal responsibility in making society better. And therefore, if we look inside us introspectively and develop ourselves spiritually, I think we would go a long way. And this was the essential foundational teaching of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. On this basis, he said that human society could go a long way and all solutions and problems could be addressed and solved. And I think that this is the way we should try to move forward, however difficult it may seem in the beginning. In the long run, it is what is going to bear good fruit. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that keynote address. We will now open the floor for an open discussion. You may forward any questions or comments that you may have. I'd like to ask you that please state your name, your affiliation before you ask your question, and then direct whatever it is that you may have to say through me, and then I will direct it to His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami. So I will take a round of hands. If you've got any questions or comments, please put your hand up and I'll signal to you.
Second hand, and is there a third hand for you? continue with those. We'll start with those two nights. So thank you very much. You may kind of station many affiliation and those
suggestions. My name is Vaisheshika Das. I'm the president of Discount Silicon Valley, California. Considering that in the Bhagavad Gita, there's mic is not on. Maybe just summarize my question. Just appreciating very much the idea of unity, I'm wondering how it corresponds with Krishna's presentation in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada's one book that Prabhupada made prominent in the world by the mass distribution, the idea of divisions in society, or an ashram, and how does that tie? How does the unity work when there are considerations externally, seemingly, in the Bhagavad Gita, and then how does that work with the idea of unity?
Well, distinctions in society will always be there on the basis of material, criteria. And I don't think that this can be removed just like that artificially. So the Vedic society recognizes those distinctions and gives people those essential slots. But people are all spiritually educated. And like I said, they don't think much about these material distinctions. Although they may be material distinctions, according to Varnashraman, they all relate with each other on the basis of their common spiritual unity. In this way, there is harmony. But when people don't understand or cannot relate or have forgotten the spiritual unity for some reason, then there are clashes. Like in India, the same Varnashrama Dharma turned out to be casteism. And you have all sorts of problems, numerous problems, even today. So the whole idea of material distinction is that material distinctions are here to stay in the material world temporarily. But we're not going to get carried away by that. We handle material distinctions very harmoniously when we have a foundational spiritual platform. That is the basis of the Bhagavad Gita's note, right? But sometimes people tend to quote these things without the spiritual affiliation, and then it causes a lot of concern in people. That's why Varnashrama is sometimes thought of as casteism, because they don't see the underlying united spiritual principle. How about you? Right?
Because of the history of South Africa has been through, we now have this constitution which holds certain values, equality, human dignity, and freedom. So for a community or a nation that's trying to build itself based on those values, and we see that we're struggling to do that despite 20 years of our democracy, how should the community understand these values that we kind of live up to in terms of, as you're saying, having a more transformative spiritual understanding of our real identity?
A good question. I think you're talking about an immediate application of these principles. Although these principles are visionary, far-reaching, and foundational, I don't think today I've covered those areas wherein we can actually implement them within the South African, scenario. But if these principles are understood by the leadership, if the people who lead the nation and the people who are leaders in all levels of society down the rank and file, if they are all educated with understanding these foundational principles of human life, then gradually, over a period of time, we can bring about these changes that we're talking about based on spiritual principles. Even within the existing situation, we can make minor changes for the good by adopting some of these principles. And a leadership that is cognizant of these type of principles can actually work out, and we'll be very happy to help in some way that we can to institute these principles down the education system, down the political system, down the judicial system, so that we can bring the necessary changes. Right? So I think the leadership should take its first step in doing that.
So where would the leadership get that understanding, that knowledge from? We've gone through the leadership of Nelson Mandela, who is known as Great Bhagavad Gita, and tried to apply some of the principles from the Bhagavad Gita. We have a current leadership which is also struggling with the same issues. So what basis of knowledge should our leadership be using to try and understand how to implement?
Well, you said it, that these foundation principles available in the Bhagavad Gita, you said Nelson Mandela was familiar with the Bhagavad Gita and he tried to, you know, apply some of those principles. These are not things that we're going to, over 20 years, be able to apply fully and see the results. But I think it has to start sometime and we can see results coming gradually. So somewhere along the line, we should do that. And these principles are available in the books of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And that's the whole reason that we are propagating this message through his books. And his books carry solutions. And people have adopted this in many different places in smaller communities and had success in operating in that way. So I'm sure that in a larger scale, scaling it would require a little more detail. And that can be worked out, and it's possible to do that. We are not speaking about something that has not been tested before. These principles mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita have been tested, have been spoken about in Indian history in the past. Even in recent times, before the British came to India, they formed a society that's based on these principles. In the famous statement of Lord Macaulay, when he came on a reconnoiter all over India, he mentioned that these people are very civilized, advanced in terms of keeping their communities together, and there's not even one beggar anywhere. This is the type of society that the Britishers came in to colonize. So these are principles that are simple principles, and human life based on that will be very progressive. It's been tested out before. So in modern times, how would you do that? And that is something Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada has shown by his brief tenure, he adopted many of these principles and created communities. And I think these principles will work. And these are available in the books of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Right?
That was the first round. Is there a second round of hands? Is there a hand there? Any other hands? Okay, I'll put a hand up.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm representing this evening Cape Peninsula University of Technology, and I work with a unit, Poverty and Literacy. And in the communities, people are tired and impatient with change because they've been let down by the leaders. Now, if we were to tell them and give them these spiritual principles, they may say we are trivializing their quest for change. But given that your understanding of spiritual principles, you've spoken about the leaders, how would you guide the students who are impatient, who may be tending towards violent solution in the country?
In my 20-minute talk, it would have been definitely difficult for me to deeply analyze this, the practicalities of how this can be applied. But sure enough, I can offer some solution. In terms of youth, poverty, education, etc., whatever type of problem there is, what I'm trying to say, whatever type of problem there is, we need to approach it with a full understanding. And a full understanding of the person, full understanding of a student, full understanding of a leadership, full understanding of anybody will be best acquired by knowing deeply spiritual principles. We said this is not something very difficult to know, at least in theory. All right. So when we start from those type of principles, I think even students, when they're educated in these principles, although in their formative years they're not very serious about many things and they are playful and they want to enjoy life and they want to take opportunities to do things, still it gets embedded in them. And when there are difficulties and problems, these things appear as solutions to them, possible solutions. So it is mentioned that these things should be taught to the children right from very, very young years. So that before they get any other type of understanding, if this is being inculcated inside, then they will stand as a foundation platform on which other things are built. And if other things which do crash, they did crash, then they'll at least get some solace from depending on these things. But as time passes, it becomes a little more difficult for us to inculcate these things. But of course, with a little education and people who are more deeply involved philosophically can understand these things. But in terms of students, in terms of poverty, in terms of all these things, so the poverty is something and the education is something that is all a situation created by our economy and the type of economy that we follow. Like I mentioned here in India before, Lord Macaulay observed that there were no beggars. And there was no new system of economy then. But over a period of time in India, there have been so many beggars. Although India is doing very good, there's another side of it, the poverty side of it. So somehow, this economy creates beggars, creates poverty more intensely. So sometimes, a spiritual solution will have to be, you know, actually used to revamp something totally, and that will take a little time. But then the main point is to see that everybody is on the same page and understands that, and then everybody offers that we should do that. And a community of people who decide to do that together, then such things become possible, right? So these are foundational things, and these are not, I'm not proposing an immediate solution. I'm proposing a foundational, I'm talking about a foundation flaw that we have, which if corrected can make easier solutions, right?
I have a question from the podium, so hopefully everybody can hear the question. I think my question is, maybe they're related, maybe they're not, but there's two aspects to it. So one of it is we hosted this evening by BBC Africa, and as we know, we're talking about having solutions to problems that we have. So one slogan that we've had is African solutions for African problems. And with the proposal that you've given this evening, my question would be, how does it relate to the continent that we're on? Because it may be a philosophy that's coming, one could argue that it's an Indo-centric philosophy that's been trying to address African problems. So that's the one part of it. The second part of it is, because of the history, I mean, you spoke about the past, so we start off with the past, and the people who were in the past, our parents, our grandparents, they wounded from the things that they went through. So how do those leaders or those custodians actually help the children as in your response to the things? So one is, how does this relate to African solutions for African problems? And the other part is, the custodians who are meant to be giving these solutions, or giving this education, actually win it for themselves.
This is a classic example. Your first part of the question is a classic example of what a material consciousness does. Our minds have got an infinite capacity to mundanize everything, including something spiritual. So my proposal here is from the works of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I am proposing, and just speaking same things that he's written in his books, that spirituality is nothing to do with material designations. So what I'm proposing is not Indian. What I'm proposing is what everybody in society is made of, whether they be Indian, American, African, or Australian, or anything. So this is not an Indian proposal. So it solves problems based on the fact that everybody in reality is spiritual in nature. That's the proposal. This is not anything to do with Indian religious stuff coming in and different types of thoughts coming in from different angles, different religions, etc. I'm speaking about a foundational principle of religion, of society and everything, essentially our identity. So whether you're an African, you're an Indian or American, you are essentially a spiritual personality. So when we recognize that, we see ourselves beyond being African and American, etc., beyond these designations. And once we see that, we are in a better position to be united. And once we are united, then we can achieve many things. I think this is the way the understanding goes. And you have to repeat the second part of your question.
The second part was how, also in the keynote address, you spoke about how leadership has a role to play in inculcating this, but our leadership are the parents and the grandparents of a wounded past. So they nestling in their hearts all these parents, and they kind of propose economic solutions, social solutions. How do they get deep to the spiritual understanding when they're carrying all these things?
I'm not saying that. When we're talking about spiritual solutions, we should do away with any material solutions to the problem. So that the leadership in the country should also attend to all the basic requirements of people. It's not that the spiritual solution is going to, like a magic wand, give you all the material solutions too. There's no doubt there's a responsibility in the leadership to also provide materially, but they should simultaneously understand foundation of spirituality. And when they do that, material problems can be handled better. Invariably, that although you provide solutions materially, there are always challenges coming up everywhere in the world. And these challenges can be handled much better if they're spiritually reinforced, right? So every great personality who is a leader, who is a king in the past, had a two-pronged responsibility, both material and spiritual. And the material things became much easier to execute when it was based on a foundation of spirituality. Right? Yeah, both have to be done.
I'll take another round of hands, the lady at the back, the gentleman in front of me, and I'll take a third hand. So, lady.
My name is P.G. Governor. I'm the principal of Monterina Secondary School. Excuse my voice, I'm losing it because of shouting at school children. doesn't come in the form of a question, but what I find ironic in this country, we've come through a lot of repression, suppression, choose the adjectives as you feel, and we've come after 20 years of democracy. What is in it for us? How is it that we cannot enjoy the freedom that we fought for? And that kind of freedom that we all sacrifice our lives for, and suddenly we're not seeing it, because on a daily basis, you are walking in fear. And then it ushers in a new type of climate in schools, where the youth are becoming rebellious. No more are they listening to the echoes. They are not listening to their echoes. If it's Youth Day, it becomes just a celebration. They are not being conscientized or sensitized by the failings of the past and not forging ahead. Inasmuch as we try all our best in schools with all the constraints where I am teaching or the principles of. Because the greater eradication in my case is to eradicate the poverty of the mind. And I'm having a challenge with that. And I have my educator next to me, who has invited me over. And how do I reconcile all these? Because I'm not having peace with it. I'm not finding the peace to enjoy the freedom that I maybe in a minuscule way contributed to.
I really sympathize with your feeling, empathize with it too, that you have a great challenge. Almost everywhere that we want to make a change, we have to go through some painful situations. All great countries who have achieved their freedom have got their own hoary past, and they've got the painful changes they've gone through and made, and they may be enjoying their freedom. That's another thing we can talk about. But the feeling that you have that I am not yet able to enjoy my freedom, although I have got it, means you have to look a little deeper into what really freedom would mean. Maybe it's something more than what you've got. Maybe you have got a cosmetic freedom. Maybe that freedom needs to be handled properly. There are many things that go into what freedom is, actually. But like I said, that we have to know what we are getting free from and what we intend to enjoy as freedom. So sometimes people have perceptions because they compare somebody else and think relatively, this is the freedom I want to enjoy. It may be a relative type of a perceptive freedom. And in your condition, in your situation and circumstance, it may not be a freedom. So we can go talking about this relatively. That's why I'm saying that what is freedom for somebody is not freedom for somebody else. In India too, after the freedom, there's been a lot of confusion for long. And many countries, they go through their own. So I think that the ethos of the place, the culture of the place, and the people of the place are the best people to solve their own problems. So at best, others can only offer guidance, some vision, some support. But you would know best how to do that. So what I have to say from the books of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada is, you will gain a lot in achieving real freedom if you would inculcate this in all your students and in your own perception. And it's not something that's like a quick fix solution that is going to happen immediately, but you will definitely gain and you will actually make progress gradually in solving these problems and genuinely experiencing freedom. Because freedom has to be experienced personally by each person. It's not just a collective perception. Each person, like you said, I don't feel free even today. Right? Maybe there are some others who are feeling free. Up, down, somewhere else. But it's a personal thing. So therefore, I think that deep internal inculcation of spiritual ideas and understanding will emancipate you personally, and you will be happy to teach this to others. And when others get emancipated within themselves, I think society will be really enjoying freedom.
And I'm actually doing African preaching in the most primary areas. And I just want to say, contribute to Maharaj's talk, that what the people have found is that everyone is looking for love. And we can actually feel this love when we're connected to the spirit soul. We know we're not this body, we're the spirit soul. And on that basis, when I preach, it's interfaith preaching because people are coming from different ethnic backgrounds, they're coming from different religious backgrounds. So we have to actually try and preach on those bases, right? To actually, in an interfaith way. And people actually see that we're doing something. We're not just, you know, saying something and not acting on it. So what I actually do is I help the community, right? If there's a debt in the community, I ask them if they need financial help like this. So in various ways, I actually try to help them. And then when we actually give out food also, like kashar distribution, and they see this. And when they see this, they actually feel that, you know, here's someone here to help us. And with this type of love that we're actually propagating, then they actually feel inclined to take up the practices of devotional life. So that's my little contribution. Actually, from the groundwork, I'm right on the ground and working with the people. So this is what I've actually found, that it's not about politics, it's not about racial discrimination. It's all about love, how to actually interact on the basis of love. Thank you, Harish.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is Rod Hale, Ipone. I'm currently the secretary of the Swami's Dvaita Goswami. I was curious to understand in your concluding story, you mentioned the story of the thief, and you explained that this is the quality of pointing externally outside of oneself. And seeing as the majority of us wouldn't identify with ourselves as thieves, per se, what does that analogy represent practically for us, the pointing externally? And also, in the analogy, it seems like it was quite a successful proposition. So I was just curious how would one understand the negative effect of that type of vision when it succeeds?
Well, again, when we lose focus on our real selves, then we have all sorts of designations, all sorts of external identities that we identify with. And that's what I'm trying to point out, that essentially if we keep on track and understand that we are spiritual beings, then we don't point out and think that somebody or something externally happening is the sole reason, and we try to set that right, unmindful of the fact that there is a foundation flaw in us thinking that I am this body and another person is this body. So I'm pointing out to that the mind has got a fantastic capacity to fool you spiritually, mundanize every spiritual instruction that comes to you, belittle it, even disparage it, and take you on a different external trip. So that's the whole point, that it's a habit in the materially conditioned personality, in the person who is deeply materially filled with material consciousness, to look outside of him and not look inside of him. The analogy is meant to illustrate that. So the whole society of people are busy looking at each other and pointing at each other and saying deep, deep, deep to each other, right? And not looking at themselves. Then you have a big problem, right? So this analogy is meant to tell us that start from inside out. When we start living from inside out, from within our spiritual personality inside, and then move towards the outside, it's far easier to handle the things outside. But when we start from outside, we get befuddled. We don't know, it gets reflected here and there, and then there's a whole lot of problem in society. So this is a foundational problem in the way we look at something. So it starts with inside us, and this is what Prabhupada told us repeatedly, that if each person cultivates his spiritual life and becomes conscious of himself, then he can reflect that in solving material problems wonderfully. Alright, clarify?
Yes.
Yeah. Alright, thank you.
Thank you, we will close out.
Thank you once again, Prasvinath Swami, for the keynote address as well as for kindly answering the questions and comments which were put forward. And I'd like to thank everyone who also contributed to the discussion and for juicing things up and for adding your thoughts in as well. At this point, we would like to extend a warm welcome to Ms. Anishin Bolton, who is the Executive Director of the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation, who will then share a special address with us. Please join me in welcoming him.
Good evening, everybody. Namaste, Vanakkam, Sawubona, and any other greeting that is applicable to you. His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami, the Boarding Trustees of Bhaktivedanta Book Trust Africa, leaders of this institution from across the globe who are here, I'm a bit at a loss in terms of why I'm here. I don't have the kind of deep spiritual knowledge and background in terms of, I think, what the occasion requires. But I'm going to respond to the topic that I was given, which is echoes of the past, social intolerances, the constitution, and the need for a fundamental shift in consciousness. Now, I approach consciousness not from the material, not from the spiritual realm, but from the material realm. And consciousness as a evolutionary process in terms of thought and action. But to start off with, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here today for a very different reason. In 1979, I finished school. And at that point in time, you had to get ministerial permission to study at any other university other than UDW, classified as Indian. The Minister of Education at the time refused my application. I came here thinking I'd be a mechanical engineer and suffered for about a month sitting in these lectures, not understanding anything about the big terminology, the heavy maths, and more than anything else, what scared me was the kind of equipment that we were meant to be using. And when I got a letter saying that the Minister of Education has approved your application to go to WITS, not to study law or anything else, but to become a teacher, I jumped at the chance. And by default, I became a teacher. Taught for 3 years, and in 88, on the very first day of school, I got a very nice letter which said, thank you very much, your services are no longer required. Signed by somebody in the House of Delegates on the 31st of December the previous year. Now, I raised this because our notions of freedom must take into account where we come from and what conditions were and where we are now and where we still need to go. But I was also surprised at the invite because I actually thought it was meant for Mr. Kathrada, who was recently in Durban to receive an honorary doctorate from DUT. And I responded positively to the invite, hoping that the organizers would realize that they had made a mistake and indicate that it was sent to me in error, and in fact they actually wanted Mr. Kathrada because, well, he's Mr. Kathrada, 26 years in jail and whatever, so, and they didn't come back and say, no, they made a mistake. But that preference would have presented me with a very different problem. Instead of speaking here, I would have had to draft a set of speaking notes, and that perhaps would have been easier. But this lecture is significant because of its timing. Not only because today is the start of Ramadan, but is historically important. Let me just cite three things. We commemorate this year, or we mark 70 years of a very significant event of 1946, the 46 passive resistance. We marked 40 years of the 1976 student rebellion, and we marked 20 years of the signing in of a new constitution. Those milestones we celebrate in this particular year. So 70 years ago, on June the 13th, 15,000 Indian people gathered in the center of town, and they marched to Ambilo and Gale Road to protest against a law which Smart's government was introducing to reduce Indian people, to further reduce them to more than second-class citizens. This law would have said where you could stay and where you could not stay, and also introduce a system of white nominees to speak on their behalf in some newly created form of governance. Under the leadership of Dr. Dadu and Dr. Naikar, Indian people decided to go back to what Gandhi had started in 1913. Gandhiji's last major act of resistance here was in 1913. The poll tax won that victory, then left in 1940. And for a period of time, this community endured a range of legislation which was primarily designed to force them to go back to India. When you look at the range of legislation that was introduced in that period, it had one objective: send them back to India. The slogan of the National Party in 1948 was premised around sending Indians back to India. So, by 1946, Indian people then had it to their full and decided that they were not going to do this. And over 2,000 of them courted imprisonment by defying that law. They started off at this resistance park in Ambilo Road, occupied it from June the 13th, were beaten up by white thugs for a period of about 2 weeks, and it's only when the women were severely beaten up that I think it got huge public reaction. This significance of this is that the matter then became a global matter. This campaign was then raised at the United Nations, and the Indian representatives there, before Indian independence, then took forward this campaign to start the isolation of South Africa. So you see the tradition of Gandhi's teachings, passive resistance, withstanding the punishment that came with it, and how this becomes a global matter then. But the fundamental thing about this was that it was a continuation of the Gandhian struggle. It saw the widespread involvement of Indian people. And when you look at them, there were carpenters, bricklayers, doctors, lawyers, merchants, all of them who courted imprisonment because they believed that a new and an alternative society was possible and worth sacrificing for. But importantly for Indian people, it inspired African people to change their own mode of struggle in this country. It inspired the generations of Mandelas and Sisulus and Tambos to begin to rethink how they needed to execute the struggle in this country. And importantly, in 1947, the year after that, it laid the basis for Indian and African unity. And that was again the kind of leadership prompted by Nehru in particular, after having been briefed by Gandhiji, that for Indian people in this country, they could only find freedom if they were going to work with African people. And that laid the basis for a decade and a half of intensive Indian-African struggle, which culminated in the drawing up of a Charter of Freedom in 1955. That charter is the basis of our new constitution, forms the fundamental basis of this new constitution. And that is why I'm referring to the 46 passive resistance. 40 years ago, the government tried to impose a language that was not preferred by African people, not understood by them, but simply to keep education, away from them as well, and try to force down Afrikaans. 600 young people died. Again, largely a non-violent form of resistance. But when you go back to 76 and you look at how much was being spent on education for different racial groups, you will also begin to see why we have some of the problems we have today. We withstood all of that. We got to 1994. We got to 1996. We had a new constitution. That constitution took almost 3 years to get the first draft out of it. It took 3 years of intensive negotiations. And many of us were at Kempton Park in those CODESA talks. A lot of trade-offs. But at the end of the day, I think what was delivered was a document that today shields this country from a whole range of ills and keeps, I think, the wolves at bay. It is a product of mass participation. It is, again, a product that we must collectively be proud of, but we need to understand. So these three pivotal moments in the last 70 years, what is common about them? There was a sense of purpose, that change was needed, that we needed to change the system, that put human dignity above all else first and foremost. Secondly, it was premised on the absolute necessity for unity to achieve those objectives. There was an element that it would entail sacrifice, but more importantly, it required selfless leadership. It requires leaders who are going to do work that they would not necessarily benefit from individually, but that would have broader societal good. And all of these key ingredients is what is required today to deal with rising social intolerances manifested through ongoing racism, xenophobia, and gender violence. I'm not going to go through all of it, but let me cite one. You have a mosque that people want to build in Pretoria, in Lodi, in Valhalla. Now, it's a place of worship. Objections are raised to building this mosque because people think, they don't know what will happen in there, they think that ISIS will be given a home at this mosque. And they protest, and they try to obstruct it. Now, it would have been the same had it been a temple or anything of the else, because it's not what that Christian Afrikaner community was accustomed to. And they resisted it. Fortunately, they're not going to win. We have had in the last few weeks, in our offices, African Muslims coming there, talking about how they are discriminated against by Indian Muslims. And simply because they are African and have taken on this faith, there's a feeling of being second class. Again, it required a different kind of intervention from us. In Durban, you sit with a very different problem. There's a generalized perception that Indians are the worst exploiters. It doesn't matter what religion you are. There's a perception that all Indians are the worst employers and the most exploitative people. Now, some of it is true. Some of it is absolutely true. But we are taking this case to the Equality Court with the Human Rights Commission, which will start in July, on the basis that that generalization is wrong. Because some do it, it cannot be generalized to everybody. Because if we accept that, then we accept that generalizations is okay on any other issue. Now, you will read more about this case in weeks to come. So what kind of consciousness is exactly required? The passive resistance brought about a new consciousness. The passive resistance not only brought a method of struggle to the public consciousness, but showed that leaders like Dado and Naito were prepared to sacrifice and were capable of leading a non-violent struggle. It also proved the readiness of people to suffer in the cause of freedom. And that is perhaps one of the biggest missing ingredients today, is the ability to put your own self-interest behind the interest of that of the broader society. We need a consciousness about what 1994 was really about. And I want to quote Nelson Mandela, because I think many people overstate what 1994 really was about, and it speaks to the question the principal had asked. And Madiba says, the truth is that we are not yet free. We have merely achieved the freedom to be free, the right not to be oppressed. We have not taken the final steps of our journey, but the first steps toward on a longer and even more difficult road. The true test of our devotion to freedom is just beginning. And this was his words in 1994. Now, the big mistake we made was to assume that 94 was freedom, and that was it. We don't have to do any more work. What the result is that many of the institutions that were building democracy in this country were dismantled. Across the length and breadth of this country, trade unions, civic organizations, even religious organizations, many of them stepped aside and gave over to the political institutions and to institutions of government. And I would say the same applies to the faith community in this country. Many of them took a back seat, focused only on their particular flock. What happened outside of their congregations was not of concern to them. With the result, we ended up with a flawed democracy that we have now. With a democracy that is not working for the majority, is not working for the poor and for the exploited in this country. Because we misunderstood what we had achieved in 1994. So this new consciousness must help to heal the divisions of the past and establish a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights, which is the preamble to our constitution. This new consciousness must continue to lay the foundations for a democratic and open society in which government is based on the will of the people and every citizen is equally protected by law. This new consciousness must daily push us all to improve the quality of life of all citizens and to free the potential of each person. It must guide us to daily build a united and democratic South Africa. This new consciousness must be mindful that it is brought about, that it was brought about on the backs of many hundreds and thousands who gave up their lives to get us to where we are. And it must lay the foundation for us to perhaps do more than those of 46, 76, and 1996. To move towards a society that we are truly free and where we are responsible for each other's well-being. And that is where my spirituality comes in. And that is how, for me, it is linked to the material conditions. I'm not at the stage where I can say to somebody who doesn't have a plate of food, we can divorce these things. And I know that's not what the Swami said. But I think that we must find ways of integrating those two issues. But fundamentally, is knowing that more needs to be done to change what we have in place today and to make it even better so that tomorrow must be better than today. Thank you very much.
A very good evening to you all. I won't take much of your time. This is just the closing for the evening. While South Africa was undergoing its own transformation from apartheid to democracy 22 years ago, a tiny Central African state called Rwanda, 4,500 kilometers away, was also undergoing its own transformation. It had just emerged from what was described as the worst episode of ethnic genocide since World War II. In this time, between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people were brutally murdered in a conflict that was based on a clash of identity between the Hutus and the Tutsis. Today, identification along ethnic lines is against the law in Rwanda. Therefore, in order to right the injustices of the past, everyone in Rwanda today is simply referred to as Rwandan. As I studied the theme of tonight's topic and compared the journey of transformation that both South Africa and Rwanda undertook, I came to realize the shifting the understanding of our identity to another temporal material designation does not actually solve the problems that our society faces. Problems such as racism, ethnic discrimination, or any other form of bodily prejudice. Because even if I define myself as Rwandan today, that does not make me American, nor does it make me Australian or Mongolian. The fact is that I am still subject to some form of bodily prejudice. And here in South Africa, we stand at a very historical milestone in our democracy. We have an opportunity to decide if our futures will still be haunted by these echoes of our past, where we have a society defined along a misidentification according to social class and skin color. This is the missing link that our keynote speaker, His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami, has alluded to in tonight's talk. Without knowledge of our own and other living beings' intrinsic nature, which is spiritual, we cannot really build communities that are truly unified and equal. In Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada's most widely read work, Sri Krishna mentions this point. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge because it gives direct perception of the self by realization. So, on behalf of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust Africa, I'd like to sincerely thank you all for attending tonight's lecture. I'd like to extend my sincere gratitude to His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami for delivering a very wonderful keynote address. I'd like to thank Mr. Bolton for joining us today and for sharing his perspective on the current political and social climate within South Africa. And then lastly, I'd like to thank each and every single one of you for coming and attending this lecture. These lectures are important in our society. The question of identity is not trivial. We should ask ourselves, who am I and what am I, every single day, in order to truly realize the purpose of life. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our program this evening. I think I will continue in the gratitude vein that Mr. Mfundangosi ended his delivery with. And I will start again by thanking His Holiness Bhaktivinoda Swami for traveling and for being with us this evening to deliver the keynote address. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Nikhin Bolton, for availing yourself this evening, as well as for agreeing to partner with the Bhaktivedanta Swami lecture. I'd like to extend a thank you as well to our international BBT trustees who have joined us this evening, as well as to Dr. Manny Singh. We'd like to thank the BBT Africa team who have come together and put all of this together. This was a job well done. I'd like to thank our actual host this evening, His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami. Thank you very much, Maharaj. And I would like to thank all of you for actually coming, contributing and for availing yourself this evening as well. Last but definitely not least, as the proverbial saying goes, we'd like to thank His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, without whom tonight would not be happening, without whom BBT Africa would not be. So we extend our gratitude to Srila Prabhupada. With that being the end, we would like to kindly invite you for refreshments and snacks outside, and you can mingle. Please take note that there are Bhagavad Gita's on sale outside as well. They're going for 60 rand. I'd like to thank you once again, and do get home safely. Thank you for joining us this evening.
I was